Okay, Council of Ephesus. This morning's lesson needs to be more interactive, so this is Sunday school, not church. I'm not a pastor. I don't preach on Sunday morning. So this morning, please ask questions at any time. I might ask questions of you as well. So Council of Ephesus. First thing is, these are the resources I use to research the council and the things that were spoken at the council. Books are up here if you want to see them, come look at them, or borrow them from me or Stephen, you can. The correct way to pronounce this word, I do not know. So it's either Theotokos or Theotokos. It means Mary, the mother of God, or actually more directly, it means the birth giver of God. So who's totally comfortable with that name? Why? Why do you have a problem with this name? As Protestants, it makes us hesitate. It makes us go, whoa, wait a minute. A birth giver of God. It's maybe an overreaction by Protestants here, but the name birth giver of God makes us really hesitate. Because Mary is elevated so high within the Roman Catholic Church that it does give us pause. But this actually is very important and was what the Council of Ephesus really was the tipping point of why the Council of Ephesus occurred. So, and this is a picture of a shrine to Mary in Ephesus. So the couple of characters at this council, the first one is Nestorius. You've probably heard his name before or heard of Nestorianism. He lived from 381 to 451. He was a monk and a priest, really known for his sermons. He was very vocal, very outspoken. And in 428, when the position came up at Constantinople, Theodosius II, who was the emperor at the time, named him or appointed him as patriarch, which patriarch you can look at as like the head bishop, or you could even say he's kind of the pope of Constantinople. He was trained, really he discipled by a guy named Theodore, and Theodore developed Antiochene theology. We'll speak more on that in just a few minutes, but Antioch had its own strain of theology, whereas Alexandria also had a different strain. So you'll see those shortly. He did not play in Lord of the Rings, even though his picture does quite look like that. One of the things that he did when he became patriarch was he convinced Theodosius II, the emperor at the time, to expel all the Arian heretics. You know, from what we've talked about in some of the Sunday school lessons before, there was a huge, really, power struggle between the prefects or emperor and the bishops or popes or patriarchs at the time of who really had the power and authority to do things. So the fact that he was appointed by the emperor was kind of interesting. It's much different than what we would do today. And then also the fact that he was able to convince Theodosius that he should get rid of the Arians because they were heretics and that they would not prosper as an empire unless they got rid of all these heretics. So he did, but in doing so, the people got a little overzealous and decided to burn the Arian heretics church, and in doing so caught a good portion of the whole town of Constantinople on fire. So, of course, he developed, as you can see, a nice little nickname of Torchy. That was his nickname from that point forward, Torchy. So one of the other things that is interesting about Nestorius is at this time, Celestine of Rome, the Patriarch of Rome, the Pope, so be it. He wasn't really called the Pope that much at this time. He was more considered the Patriarch of Rome, even though that was as we spoke about last week, that was kind of the highest ranking bishop or patriarch was in Rome. The head of the Pelagian heretics fled Rome, and he came down to Nestorius's place in Constantinople, and he gave him shelter, and I thought this was interesting, the way they put it in the book, is he gave him shelter and hospitality. So we talk about hospitality here a lot. So he didn't just give him protection from being arrested or beaten. He actually offered him hospitality and took him in. You'll see why this is important later with a lot of his theology and how that how that kind of works together. But it's also important to know that whenever he did this, he wasn't really making a good friend in Rome in doing this. So he kind of created an enemy at that time. Okay, the other most important member of this council that's to know is Cyril. You'll notice the picture. This is his statue in one of the Roman, well, no, I'm sorry, it was in Turkey. It's his statue of him. You see he's got a staff on a guy's neck. That's Nestorius. So that's what he is most known for, is this right here. So he lived from 376 to 444. He was the Patriarch of Alexandria from 412 to 444. What's one of the things that's important to note is that he was patriarch for quite a while before Nestorius came into the picture in Constantinople. So he was very experienced, had a lot of experience. He was an avid writer. You would look at him and compare him to somebody like Luther or Calvin or one of the guys who wrote extensively about his doctrine and theology and what he understood. He wrote extensively. There are a number of books that he wrote, and I did not list them all here because there were quite a few, but they are still used today, especially in the Catholic Church. But according to what we're going to be dealing with in Ephesus, he wrote quite extensively. So he was very learned. He did study and referenced often many of the early church fathers as well. So he was very well known. And he's also a very savvy politician. So while you see that a little bit here in the West, this was so much more important in the early church, that when you held this kind of position, a bishop position or a patriarch, it was not just about shepherding your flock. It was much bigger than that, because you were having a power struggle with the emperor. There was a whole lot more. They thought the society as a whole needed to be Christian, which you do see in the West, but not in the manner in which they do it here. So he was a very savvy politician. He understood the need for the alliances with the emperor and other bishops, and he was just very determined. He was the nephew of Theophilus of Alexandria, who was the patriarch before him. So he basically grew up with his uncle being the head, being the patriarch of Alexandria, and he shadowed him his whole life. So he understood, exactly what was expected of a patriarch and how they acted, which you will see the influence as he goes on of how that really influenced the way that he dealt with things. He took over as patriarch after his uncle's death. I thought this was also interesting, a little bit different than here. So, in a Baptist church, if a pastor dies, there might be who's going to take over as pastor might be a little bit of a discussion, and some issues may come up. But here there were two main bishops at the time that were vying for that position, and so each of them had their own little group of followers, so they just went in the streets and had a big brawl, and basically whoever won kind of really helped, and Cyril's side did actually win. That isn't why he was named the patriarch, but the fact that he did kind of showed his dominance, that he was going to be the new head of the church. One of the other interesting things that happened during his reign was there was a murder of a lady named Hypatia. I don't know if you've ever heard of her. She's actually well known throughout history. She was an astronomer, philosopher, and mathematician. Her death was attributed to him, not that he did it, but that his followers did it. And so he was given a lot of he was just given the reputation for the person who either ordered it or didn't really speak out against it so much. Hypatia was an important character because she actually trained a lot of the people who became bishops throughout the empire. Because she was such a good mathematician and astronomer, she did train a lot of them, and also in philosophy. So a lot of them were very familiar with her. They would come from far away to see her. And her murder was really because of the struggle between Cyril and the prefect at the time, the civil authority at the time. And she was counsel for the civil authority. And whenever there was an issue between the Christians and the civil authority because of some discontent amongst the Jews and the pagans and the Christians, she was thought to be his main counsel. And the Christians believed, or at least the gentleman who... and the group who murdered her, believed that she was being causing Cyril and the prefect to not be able to come to an agreement. They were she was accused of influencing him to not give in to Cyril, and so that's she ended up being murdered. They took her from her home and drug her to a church and murdered her. It was actually quite gruesome. If you want to know the details, I'll tell you later, not in this, in all the mixed company, but it was actually pretty bad. He also, as you can see the last point, he did help move more of the civil authority to the church's control. Now, this is not necessarily a good thing. It's the rule of the town started to be performed by monks. And so monks sort of took over as the police force, or they were more of a religious police force. And so it became much more difficult for, like, the Roman military to do anything at this time. It was more of the monks were coming in and handling most of the civil authority. This is where the power struggle started. And you'll see this throughout, you know, through the rest of the Roman Empire. Is it the Pope that has the power, or is it the Emperor that has the power, and how that goes back and forth? You really started to see that manifest itself in Alexandria at this time. There was quite a struggle between them. Okay, background of why they held the Council of Ephesus. The Alexandria and Antioch churches were very jealous of the position of the Patriarch of Constantinople, because in the previous council, the Patriarch of Constantinople was given a higher ranking. He was given more authority, sort of like the Roman Patriarch was given authority a couple councils ago. Since the head of the Roman Empire moved to Constantinople, that highest among equals was given to Constantinople. So there was actually a battle for who would be that patriarch, and Antioch and Alexandria followed two different strains of theology. So it'd almost be like the Catholics and the Protestants vying for who would be president of the United States. And it was these two different factions vying for, could they get their candidate to become that patriarch? And so you saw a real battle, and of course they were very, very jealous. If their guy wasn't in, they didn't like the Patriarch of Constantinople. They wanted to bring him down. Which brings us to the second point, the Synod of the Oak. The Alexandrian patriarch before Theophilus. He was instrumental in bringing down the patriarch of Constantinople before this, John Chrysostom. He brought him down by the Synod of the Oak and basically had him declared a heretic and had him lose his position. He got reinstated by the emperor right thereafter, but he was successful in causing a big rift and getting him to be thought of by most of the Christians throughout the world as somebody who wasn't worthy of that position, and he lost a lot of his authority at that time. So you had the Antiochene and Alexandrian theology. So what's the difference? When we saw before, the council before, if you remember talking, they started dealing with Apollinarianism. The last council, this council, and the next one, you will be dealing a lot with Christology. That's really what they were trying to work out. You had the Nicene Creed, which stated, you know, fairly well what we believed about Christ, that he was the Son of God, and it was pretty clear. However, how does that work itself out? That's what they were dealing with at the time of Ephesus. You have the Antiochenes, who were really emphasizing the humanity of Christ. They really emphasized Jesus' human side, and the Alexandrian side was really emphasizing the Logos, or the God side of his nature. So whenever Nestorius, the head of Constantinople, he was Antiochene, he was taught by an Antiochene, so he really started to emphasize the human side of Christ and started to neglect the God side of Christ. As a matter of fact, what ended up happening was, in some of his writings, he was emphasizing it so much, the way that he was describing Christ is that he was human and he was not the Logos. As soon as Cyril caught wind of this, he started to write letters to him and say, okay, this is a guy I don't like anyways because he's in the political power of position in the church that I don't want him there anyway. So now I've found a reason to go after him. Let's go after him. So they wrote a series of three letters I listened to. I listened to those on YouTube. They had a a guy read the letters back and forth between them. Very heated. It kind of looked like it was probably between James White and some Mormon. So they were very heated back and forth. They were going at each other quite extensively about what is it, who is Christ? What is he made up of? Is he just a man? Cyril accused him of adoptionism. I don't remember. Did we talk about adoptionism in here last week? Okay, so adoptionism is the idea that Christ was a man. He was born as a man. And then later on, God sent down the Logos to indwell in him. So he was not born as deity and humanity. He was only born as a human. And then later, the Logos was adopted into him. So this was adoptionism, and then it was a heresy that was refuted fairly quickly. But because of Nestorius really emphasizing the human side, he was accused of adoptionism because he made a couple of silly statements about not being able to worship a baby. That didn't make sense to him, that the Logos could not be a baby. So that just doesn't make sense. Which, and when you start to think about it, is something kind of tough to wrap your mind around. The Alexandrian theology and what Cyril promoted was that, no, Jesus was not two separate people. He was not the Logos and he was not a man kind of blended together, but that he was one person but had two different natures, human and divine. And so in their letters back and forth, they began to discuss, and a word came up, Theotokos, which is Mary, the mother of God. So when that came up, Nestorius could not call her that. He did not see that it was possible for her. How could God have a mother? That makes no sense. He was eternal, and Mary was not. So it made no sense to him. And so that's when that happened, whenever he could not agree to call him that, he would call him Christotokos, which was basically the human side of Christ, but could not call him that. That was the trigger that allowed them to call a council. Like, what are we supposed to do? This argument's been going on for years. It's not different now. You can't just Facebook and get it all taken care of in 48 hours. This happened over years of letters going back and forth over months at a time. And so, finally, in 430, there was a... they both appealed to the Pope in Rome and said, we can't come to an agreement on this. Help us out. Because he was totally neutral. So they appealed to him, and it didn't go so well for Nestorius. So it went really bad. The Pope declared that Cyril was right in what he was saying and that Nestorius was wrong. And so when he did that and sent the information, sent the letter back to them saying that I'm agreeing with Cyril, Cyril then wrote a letter to Nestorius that was hugely inflammatory. He basically demanded that he quit teaching, listed 12 different anathemas about him and his teaching that was really kind of purposeful to, he won. He liked to destroy people whenever he won an argument. We know people like that. So that was his goal. And so he really inflamed him to where now it didn't settle it. It made it even worse. So finally, by this time, the emperor was said, that's enough. We're going to call a church council and bring all of the bishops together. Bring everyone in. Let's have a council and let's discuss this and get it settled once and for all. So they called the council. It was supposed to be held in Constantinople. But remember earlier I told you how Nestorius was not as savvy a politician, and he kind of made it. He didn't make a complete enemy of the Roman emperor by burning down the town, but the emperor's sister, Pulcheria, loathed and detested him. Did not like him at all, made a huge enemy of him for years and years. So whenever the council was getting ready to be held, she decided, let's not do this in Constantinople, which is largely more anti-Achaean in their theology. Let's move it to Ephesus, because Ephesus is very pro-Mary. As a matter of fact, they have a shrine to Mary in the town, and the townspeople are much more accepting of the name Mother of God. They venerated Mary quite extensively. They liked her. So they moved it to Ephesus. This was a big deal because the bishops, as they came in, they dealt with the people and the church all the time. And so many people were there, and that probably did have some influence on them as well. So they decided to hold this council. Everyone starts to show up, but everyone is late. Nestorius and Cyril are there, but many of the bishops are late. Many of the people, the Roman emperors, the Pope from Rome is not, he has not arrived, his contingent has not arrived. The emperor is his contingent is there, but many of them are not. And what was really important is John of Antioch, who was the patriarch of Antioch at the time, who obviously was very much pro-Nestorius, and he was his biggest defender, and was one of the most, it was very powerful at the time. He was thought well of by all, even though he did believe more in the side that Nestorius did. He was his chief defender. He was not there yet. So it was now 2 weeks past the time to start. Well, Cyril, being a savvy politician, he somehow got them to read the emperor's intro, which once you did that, that officially started the council. He somehow kind of tricked them into going ahead and reading it. And once they read it, the council was able to start. So they started the council, and Nestorius, of course, was none too thrilled, because hardly any of his contingent that believed the way that he did was there. So he refused to actually come to the council. So there were only a handful of bishops that believed in Nestorius' way there, and then a huge contingent from Cyril's side that was there, and the Roman contingent was not there, the Rome's contingent. So they debated, and of course the debates were fairly short, because there was not a whole lot of people to debate against them. And the vote really kind of fell along ethnic lines. I thought this was kind of interesting. If they were Syrian, they followed Nestorius. But if they were Egyptian, Roman, everything else pretty much fell into Cyril's camp. So he was quickly confirmed that what he believed was heresy, that what he was saying was heresy. And they excommunicated him. Took him out of his post, said you couldn't be there. So they had that vote, but then they had some other issues to deal with, and they were wrapping up that council. And as they're wrapping up the council, here comes John of Antioch in. And so John of Antioch comes in and says, whoa, 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 you can't do this. And of course, the council's pretty much over, and they're like, we already started it. And so John of Antioch says, forget that, we're starting our own council. So he starts another council while he's there, which is, of course, made up of mostly those who believed the way that Nestorius did. So he starts that council, and you can guess how it went. They reinstated Nestorius, they excommunicated Cyril, and all of the bishops who participated in it in the first council. So the Council of Ephesus, since they hadn't completely wrapped up, they decided to do the same, and they added all of the bishops that were in the other council, they excommunicated them as well. So now you have two guys that are not liking each other, and none of them are getting their way, so everybody's pitching a nice fit. So you have two different councils that have made two different decisions. What are you supposed to do? Well, there's really a couple of different stories about what happened. Here, let's go back. There we go. So we'll deal with how they ended, but in the debates, we need to discuss what they actually debated when they were there. We discussed a little bit. Cyril really defended the fact that Jesus was one person. He was not a God and he was not a man, that were two separate people coming together. This is really what Nestorianism is being criticized of. So Cyril really emphasized that God could not be two different people. He's one person. He's one person and he's got two different natures. So some of the history books say that there was really just a misunderstanding of language here. And as years have gone on, you see that softening against Nestorius. As a matter of fact, there are many who don't believe he was a heretic at all. They believe that it was more just a misunderstanding and that it was not as big an issue as we've made it out to be, or that the council made it out to be. And it centers around the word physis. So the word physis, it could mean person or nature. It kind of means both. But in an earlier council, or some other church fathers kind of got together and they determined that physis was really meant person. That it really means person, not necessarily nature, but it means person. So how some of the history books portray it, those that are soft on Nestorius, say that it was really a misunderstanding that In Nestorius' mind, he was really speaking of natures, that Christ had two natures. And Cyril was interpreting that physis to mean that he was saying God, that Christ was two persons. This actually, while it seems a little bit confusing, is has huge implications. There are huge implications to it. So what are those implications? So in Nestorius' view, he believed that Jesus was just a man, and then God later came down and filled him and did some things. You could perform miracles and do things that he was attributed to him. But because he was just a man, everything that he did, his temptation and everything, was done just as a man. There was no divinity there. It was all just a man. And that he chose to be the Christ, that he was somebody who could choose to not sin until that time came, whenever he was indwelled by the Logos. This was important. As you noticed earlier, he gave fellowship to a Pelagian, the head of the Pelagians. So why is this important? You remember what Pelagians believe. Pelagians believe that it is not something in God. It is not divine. They don't believe in election. They don't believe that God actually has to change a man's heart. They believe that God does that only after man chooses. That man was not completely completely depraved at the fall, that he still has the ability to make the choice to do good or evil, and not only do evil. So in Pelagianism, you have that ability. Well, this is what he believed about Christ. This is why he thought Christ, it was so important that Christ chose to do that. And a Pelagian would very much back up what he believed. So there's consequences to this, one, because of the Pelagian view, but also because he did not view Christ as divine. Muslims love him. The Mohammedans agreed with him. They actually use his writings, some of his writings, in their understanding of who Christ was. They agree with him because they don't believe that Christ was divine, that he had he was not Emmanuel, God with us. He was not actually somebody who had who was the Logos. So it makes sense. They like Nestorius. That didn't necessarily happen at the time that he was debating this, but it did very quickly thereafter. The Mohammedans very much agreed with him. So that should probably be a red flag for you in the first place, but that was the case. So Cyril also, at the council, he did accuse, as we discussed earlier, Nestorius of adoptionism, which had already been shown as heresy. So this was very believable, because there was also a very famous adoptionist from Nestorius' hometown in Constantinople who had just recently come out from there. He was very well known. He was the leading adoptionist at the time. And so because he came out from there and Nestorius was from there, when Cyril made this accusation, it was very easy to say, oh, well, that makes complete sense. He sat underneath Nestorius and came out with that view. Nestorius is soft on that view. Plus, he's soft on Pelagianism. None of this is good. This can't work out well. So this is what they were debating. Is Christ divine and man, or is he just man? This is what the debate was over. And this follows along with some of the other stuff from the council before. It was an extension of what they had already determined from the council before. Everyone was trying to figure out, okay, based on what happened the last time, what does that mean? So they're still working out Christology. This is well over 100 years. We're still trying to figure this out. Probably longer than that. Okay, so what happened at the end? There's actually two different stories. So I gave you both of them. So the first story, and different history books tell a different story, is that the Pope's contingency arrived from Rome. That they arrived, looked at what was going on and said, okay, guys, stop. And sat down, and since both of them had appealed to Rome before, that they were doing this again. And the Pope listened to both sides of the story and declared that Cyril's counsel was valid because technically it followed all of the rules. It started 2 weeks late. You know, the time was fine and the emperor's edict was read. So everything was done officially the way that it was supposed to. And the Roman Patriarch obviously agreed with Cyril in the first synod that he held. So it makes sense that he would agree with him as well. Now, as the story goes, after that happened, Nestorius was booted out. But John of Antioch, who really led the other council, and Cyril, the Roman patriarch, had them sit down and say, look, we cannot divide the church over this. Y'all need to come up with something. You need to come up with an agreement, something that everyone can agree on. So they came up with something that was called the Formula of Union. And we'll go over that in just a minute, but that's how this came to be. Ending number two showed, in some of the books, was different. The emperor got wind of everything that was going on, and he got tired of listening to him, so he jailed both of them. Not Nestorius. He just let Nestorius go on his way. He was kind of shamed and banished. But he took John of Antioch and Cyril and put them both in prison and said, I'll figure this out later. I'm putting you both in prison because there's going to be rioting everywhere. It's important to understand the culture at this time. It's a lot like it is in the Middle East today, where there is a lot of rioting, and the Christians were no different than any of the other people in the town. You had it quite extensively. As a matter of fact, I did watch a movie I don't necessarily recommend that dealt with Hypatia and her murder, called Agora, which had Rachel Weisz in it, and it was interesting because it went over all of this stuff that was happening at this time frame. It dealt with Cyril a lot. It didn't really deal with Nestorius, but it dealt with Cyril and what happened to her. And it wasn't completely historically accurate, but it gave you kind of an idea of what it was like at that time. And the people did. They rioted. At this time in Alexandria, the Jews attacked the Christians secretly at night because the Christians were very antagonistic of the Jews. So they attacked them at night, killing them by telling them the church was on fire. They had them come into the church because they all thought it was on fire, and a bunch of them ran in the middle of the night. They locked the doors behind them and stood up at the top, and they pelted them with rocks and killed many of them. And then in retaliation, Cyril took a Christian mob, which they didn't realize there were actually that many Christians, I guess, in the city. And they came and basically ripped all of the Jews out of their homes and booted them out of the town and took their possessions and let everyone come and plunder them. And so from that point forward, there were no Jews in Alexandria. Just a couple years before, the same sort of scenario happened with the Christians and the pagans. The pagans attacked the Christians. The Christians returned and attacked the pagans. And in doing so, finally, the emperor came in and said, okay, I got to make a decision here. Because of what they did, we're going to forgive what the pagans did, but you can have their temple and library. And they went in and destroyed their temple and library and everything in it, but allowed the pagans to go on. So you had this sort of thing occurring everywhere all of the time. It was not a real civil society, I guess you could say, even though it was an advanced society. So this sort of thing took place all the time. So whenever he puts them in jail, this is to stop the rioting, the death. And so he put them in jail and said, I'll figure this out. Let me just put you guys in jail so we can stop all of this madness, and I'll sit and listen to you guys and make a determination. And in doing so, he sided with Cyril. Again, remember Nestorius kind of caught a lot of his city on fire based on what he told the emperor Theodosius to do at the time. So, and plus his sister didn't really like him either. So he had a couple of strikes against him. So he's not as savvy a politician, which when you get in a debate and somebody likes one guy but not really the other, you're going to tend to lean towards one way as well. So he did lean that way, and he sided with Cyril. But in doing so, he basically wouldn't let them out of prison until they came up with a formula of union, the exact same thing they're talking about here. Till John and him came up with some sort of agreement that everyone could live with to stop the fighting and to keep the church together. And that's what. So there's two different stories about what happened at the ending. It's probably somewhere in between, because I know at one point they were both arrested, but it doesn't really say exactly what happened. So there may be somewhere in between this happened. Basically, John of Antioch and Cyril had to come up with something to agree on to keep the church united. They came up with the formula of union. So, in conclusion of the council, Nestorius was exiled, and as the story goes, most of his followers left as well when he was exiled. They moved east towards Persia. Some of the books will explain that when they moved east towards Persia, that they went and they planted churches in Iran, along the coast of China. They moved way east. And in doing so, they opened churches there. It's kind of, are these actual churches? Are these good churches? Or are these actually, you know, not good churches? Is the gospel actually being spread, or is it not being spread? There's you know, some question about that. But the fact of the matter was, the scriptures and Christianity was moved that direction as a conclusion of this. Whether the churches were good or not, that's another thing, but it was sent to the East. Another thing that was really important is the term communicato idiomatum was popularized. This is important because this is how we understand a lot of Christology. So we're discussing the idea of Christ being human and divine. How do you wrap your mind around that? How do you deal with that? And what exactly does that mean? So the communicata idiotum, or communication of properties, or communication of idioms, it became popularized during this debate. It was brought up. I'm going to read you a definition that I looked up. It's a Christological concept about the interaction of deity and humanity in the person of Jesus Christ. It maintains in that view of the unity of Christ's person, his human and divine attributes and experiences might properly be referred to his other nature so that the theologian may speak of the suffering of God. In other words, this is how we say God died on the cross. Okay, well, God can't die, right? That's impossible. So we can communicate that, the whole idea of Christ dying on the cross and the different his different attributes, his divine and his human side. We can say God died on the cross, but we know what is meant by that. That's what this word means. It's the communication of the properties of each of his sides. So his divine side, when we're communicating him about his divine nature, we can use that about his human nature. It's still talking about the same person, but we don't literally mean that God died on the cross. We mean that Christ died on the cross. And also there are certain ways, like this definition, the suffering of God. We know that God can't suffer. This became very important, and this was actually one of Nestorius' arguments, is when you deal with impassibility. We dealt with that quite a bit a while back. And as a matter of fact, I referenced the ARBCA position paper on it because they specifically talked about the incarnation and how do you deal with impassibility in the incarnation, because Christ suffered pain, he felt temptation, you know, all of these things. So how do you say that about God if he's impassible? This was Nestorius's argument. How do you deal with that? God can't feel these things necessarily, so how do you deal with that? Well, the ARBCA position paper deals with it directly, and I'd like to read that to you to give you an idea of how they dealt with it. Some have attempted to argue against the confessional position by an appeal to the doctrines of the incarnation and the sufferings of Christ. Failing to maintain the creator-creature distinction, some ascribe suffering to the divine nature of Christ and even to the Father and Holy Spirit. These are mistakes with mammoth implications. The doctrine of communicato idiomatum, or the communication of idioms, is important in a discussion. Muller defines this as communication of proper qualities, a term used in Christology to describe the way in which the properties or idiomata of each nature are communicated to or interchanged in the unity of the person. To what is this referring? The confession, the London Baptist Confession, gives assistance at this point. Christ in the work of mediation acteth according to both natures, by each nature doing that which is proper to itself. Yet by reason of the unity of the person, that which is proper to one nature is sometimes in Scripture attributed to the person denominated by the other nature. So among the texts cited in the Second London Baptist Confession are Acts 20:28. Take heed therefore unto yourselves and to all the flock over which the Holy Ghost hath made you overseers to feed the church of God, which he hath purchased with his own blood. So you see that right there, the church of God that he purchased with his own blood. Well, we know that God's a spirit. He doesn't actually bleed. He's talking about Christ. So you can this is an idea of communicating those properties one side to another. Now it can also be a difficult thing to understand, and I know many people just don't like to get that deep theologically when you're dealing with Christology about how you actually handle Christ as a human and Christ as divine. But it's a very important distinction that we have to make. He was only one person. And when he was born, he had to be born as man and divine at the same time. So it is not a phrase about Mary so much to call her the mother of God. That's not what this argument was about. It really had very little to do with that. It was actually a phrase about Christ. And when Christ was born, was he divine or was he not? So the point was, absolutely he was divine. He was always God and man together in one person. Not two different people, but one person. And so Mary can be called Theotokos, the mother of God or the birth giver of God. It does not mean that she literally gave life to God, the Father, the Trinity. It means that she gave birth to Christ, who was divine and human. So it is okay to call her Mary, the mother of God. Now we know where this leads. In our sinfulness, we take things and expand on them. And you see within many of the Roman church how this was expanded and moved further along, so that Mary was basically given a higher place than almost than anyone else. And at some points further down the road here shortly, Mary's worshipped more than Christ, because then they developed the idea even further that Mary must have been sinless as well in order to give birth to Christ, because all of these things will connect. Christ was sinless, then Mary had to be sinless. So I don't know how far back in the line you go, but Mary was sinless somehow. So they moved that along even further. So they took something that was really meant to be something about Christ and moved it along further to talk about Mary. So you can't blame the early church for what happened later on. They actually made the right decision. Theotokos, she is the mother of God because Christ was divine and human as well. So let's talk about this formula of union. Either way, at the end, the church had to come to some sort of agreement as to what happened here. Can y'all see that? Or is that really small? It looks pretty small. Aaron, all right. And he's old, so if he can read it, y'all can read it. So let's go ahead and look over, because it's important, because this was the conclusion of what happened. Out of the Council of Ephesus, this is what came from it. The forming of union, whether it was the emperor who made him do it, whether it was the Pope in Rome who made him do it, John and Cyril came to an agreement, and it kept the church from completely splitting wide open. So here's what it says. We will state briefly what we are convinced of and profess about the God-bearing Virgin and the manner of the incarnation of the only begotten Son of God, not by way of addition, but in the manner of a full statement. Even as we received and possess it from the Holy Scriptures and from the tradition of the Holy Fathers, adding nothing to the creed, but forward by the Holy Fathers at Nicaea. This was important as well. This did not add to the Council of Nicaea. It did not take anything away from the Nicene Creed. It did not take anything away from it, did not add to it, but it was more describing this is what is meant by what it says in the Nicene Creed. For as we have just said, that creed is sufficient both for the knowledge of godliness and for the repudiation of all heretical false teaching. We shall speak not presuming to approach the unapproachable, but we confess our own weakness and so shut out those who would reproach us for investigating things beyond the human mind. We confess then our Lord Jesus Christ, the only begotten Son, perfect God and perfect man of a rational soul and body, begotten before all ages from the Father in his Godhead, the same in the last days for us and for our salvation, born of Mary the Virgin according to his humanity, one and the same, consubstantial with the Father in the Godhead and consubstantial with us in humanity. For a union of two natures took place. This is that hypostatic union that I don't know, most of you have probably heard that word before. This is where that comes from. This word was used extensively in this council. Therefore, we confess one Christ, one Son, one Lord. According to this understanding of the unconfused union, we confess the Holy Virgin to be the Mother of God, because God the Word took flesh and became a man, and from his very conception united himself, the temple he took from her. As to the evangelical and apostolic expressions about the Lord, we know that theologians treat some in common as one person and distinguish others as two natures and interpret the God-befitting ones in connection with the Godhead of Christ and the lowly ones with his humanity. So, yes, we've talked about this before in church, and I think in the last year or so, That yes, we do talk about Christ's humanity and Christ's divine nature, his Godhead, separately. You can attribute the things, as we went through the impassibility studies, we went through the things when you're talking about his humanity versus talking about his divine nature. This formula really kind of put in place what we're going to see next in Constantinople. It really started to wrap up that hypostatic union. How do you deal with one person that has two natures? Because we don't experience this in life today so much. So this is, you know, Christ is unique. It is only one person, but he has those two natures. So in light of that, do y'all have any questions?